Hal Herzog is in Weaver. He's in the Smoky Mountains of North Carolina, Weaverville, is what they call it anyway. He's written the book. He knows everything there is to know about animals. He knows more about animals than he does about people, I swear. This book is called Some We Love, Some We Hate, and Some We Eat. Hal Herzog's on the phone with us now. Hi, Hal. How are you?
I'm doing good. How are you, Michael?
I'm fine. Thank you. I was just, you know, when I was being very needy of my dog this morning, I thought about you and your book.
Good.
We need them so much more than they need us. I mean, that's really what annoys me. I mean, I would do anything for my dogs, and very few of them would have done anything for me.
They probably gave you love and affection.
I know, but that's not enough. I'm saying, you know, bring me treats.
You're asking a lot.
I know. Once, bring me a treat. You know, I have a little puppy now. It's undisclosed origin from an Amish farm. And she's part poodle and part unknown fiber. She's very nice and stuff, but she's training me. You know, it just occurred to me that, you know, that isn't that true, Hal? I mean, dogs and other pets, really what the deal is, they train their owners to give them treats for doing nothing, basically.
That's been my experience,
yeah.
And it's particularly true, I think, with cats. With cats, at least for me, that love has been sort of a one-way street, you know, from me to Tilly rather than from Tilly to me.
You mean it's conditional? Cat love is conditional, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that's right. It's conditional. I think that unconditional love idea, of when people say pets provide unconditional love, I'm pretty sure most of them are talking about dogs.
What is the thing with women and cats?
It's interesting that women are more likely to have cats than men.
What is that?
But it used to be that cat keeping was associated with witchcraft. So if a woman owned a cat, that she could get burned at the stake.
Oh. So they're making up for it now by having all
apparently,
these.
Apparently, yes, that's right.
Yes, I once dated a girl who slept with a cat on either side of her, and that didn't last long.
I'm not going to go there.
No, I wouldn't. I didn't either. To tell you the truth, but I gave it a good try. Then the claws come out, you know. And it's, oh, so you know, give me a dog lover any day, I guess. Well, if you're a dog lover, you'll probably like men. That's the way I look at it.
I think that may be true.
Okay. Are there some animals that you feel like you, now you're in psychology, but it's almost like you're in animal psychology, right? You understand these animals from the inside out. Fair to say?
Well, I used to do that. I used to be in animal behaviors, but in fact, I developed the first personality test for snakes, and I think it's still the only personality test. No, I am very serious about this.
How did anyone know that they had personalities? You were the first one.
But I shifted gears, and now I basically study the human side of the human-animal relationship.
Yeah, well, I don't care about that so much, but snakes have personalities?
Oh, yeah, you should. Yeah, yeah.
Then why have you been bitten more than any human being on Earth, if you understand?
Oh, because my personality test involved me in a series of trials, standardized trials. I would wave my finger in front of the snake and count the number that would bite my finger. So I've been bitten by snakes many, many thousands of times.
Yeah. This is why you've gone into humans instead of
yeah,
snakes.
Yeah, my finger's shorter than it used to be, too.
Yeah. Do your human patients bite you eventually as well?
No.
You hold a Guinness Book record for being bitten by snakes, right?
You know, I don't. I should, but I never submitted the information. However, I published a number of papers on this, and if you count the number of times in those papers, I'm pretty sure I would win.
Doesn't that all call into question your credentials as an animal behaviorist?
Oh, come on now. You're being a little cynical, aren't you? I am on your show.
I know, Hal, but come on. You know, love the book. I get the idea here, but that, you know. You purposely tried to get snakes to bite you.
Yeah, that's how I measured their personality. I was interested in the aggressive parts of their personality.
Uh-huh. Okay,
and I found that the principles of snake personality are basically the same principles of human personality.
Oh, that I believe. Go ahead, take an apple. I can see that. Yeah, go ahead, try. You like it? No problem. Lots of them up there. Tell snakes by personality now. What for a person just starting out with snakes? What would you recommend in a snake as far as personality? You know, possibly a good pet snake.
No, I would recommend that a snake that you have in your area, which is the Butler's Garter Snake.
And oh, we have those.
They're the Labrador Retriever of snakes.
They're the ones that keep coming into my kitchen between the floorboard and the wall, and I pull them out, and it pulls them in half, and they smell terrible.
That would be the ones, and they're easy to keep. They don't poop very much. They eat worms every now and then, and you know they're affectionate and cute.
All right,
you might think about getting rid of that puppy, get one of those Butler garters.
Yeah, or I could just let her get worms. Then I can have both.
Yeah, absolutely.
A puppy with worms. You say affectionate. Does a snake, or let's say other reptiles as well, do they show affection in your studies?
Truth is, no. They're about like my cat. No, my cat's better than a snake.
Yeah. All right. Here are some things. Ants. I just saw this in the news the other day. Look, this is a headline. Lazy ants sit around doing nothing while their nest mates work. Reaction. He said that half of the ants were sitting around doing nothing when he studied the Temnothorax rugatulus.
Well, that's I think the old aphorism, 20% of the people do 80% of the work. I think that's generally true across many species. So that wouldn't surprise me that applies to ants as well.
Yeah, but what about get thou to the ant, thou sluggard, the get thee to the ant, thou sluggard. The Bible thing. Look to the ant for in terms of whatever that is they do.
Yeah, we think of them as being industrious.
Industrious, that's it.
Yeah, absolutely. We think of them as being industrious. And I've been in the tropics and seen these army ants carrying and leafcutter ants carrying leaves that are 100 times bigger than their own bodies, and they're working pretty hard.
And that's the other thing. Now, Ant-Man is like a hero now. How much can they carry? Because I tried to find out, in some places they say an ant can carry 5,000 times its weight. Some say 50 or just a few times its weight, depending. Maybe it's according to the ant?
Well, when I get a question like that, I have to make a choice. Mm. And the choice is, should I lie and make something up?
Yeah.
Or should I admit that I don't have a clue? And I think I'll lie, and I'll say they can carry 8,500 times their body weight.
Has this ever been part of your studies?
I've never studied ants.
Short circuit and applause.
My interaction with ants is that if there's too many of them around, I sometimes step on them.
All right. Pandas and first of all, pandas are not really lovable, are they?
That's a great question. No, you're wrong. They are lovable.
Oh.
Because we look at them and we have this little thing of love hormone, oxytocin that comes out. So we find them lovable because they have these big looking eyes. Their eyes aren't really that big, but they have those patches, and they look really cute. They look like teddy bears.
They do.
So they're lovable only in the sense that we project our love on them. In terms of being as lovable as that, being loving to you, that would probably be a huge mistake.
No, because they're vicious. Yeah, aren't they vicious? I mean, they're worse than wolverines, and they're kind of cute.
I guess this is one of the principles of human-animal interactions, is that we project our wishes and desires on these creatures. It's not a matter of what the actual biological truth is. It's what we want it to be.
Yeah. And the shoots and leaves thing, I read somewhere that they cannot digest bamboo. Can you explain that?
Yes, I can explain that. Yes, I could. But I won't.
Go ahead. Is that where?
Because then I would be faced with making things up thing, which I already used once. I already used that card once. So I guess in this time I'll think I don't have a clue about pandas.
Yeah, you don't know about pandas at all.
I'm not a very good guest, huh? No, I don't know that much
so far, but we'll see. There's still time. You could pull this out yet. Hard to digest bamboo. Their stomachs still retain the gut bacteria of the omnivorous creatures they evolved from, but their own So they, I don't know, through evolution, they can eat, digest it, but really they can't, is what I get from it.
Now, I'm supposed to believe you about this?
It was on the Internet.
Oh, it's on the Internet. The scales are removed
All right.
from my eyes.
All right,
you didn't
Hal,
say it was on the Internet.
All right, Hal, let's try something a little more up your alley. This 50-million-year-old sperm they found in Antarctica.
Yeah, I did see that one, yeah.
Exciting or what?
I thought it was pretty exciting, and I thought was what is even better was your question about it, which was how the hell do you find one sperm?
Yeah.
I guess the place
isn't the real question there.
Female whale, wouldn't you? Wouldn't that be the place that you would look?
No. It's a worm, right? It's a worm sperm.
I thought you said it was a whale sperm.
It's a worm sperm. A whale sperm, you'd run into it, you'd say, "Oh God."
Yeah, but it could have been a.
What is that?
Been,
oh, that's
been,
just a whale sperm.
It could be like one of those Russian doll sets. It could have been a sperm.
We didn't know where
whale.
To put it.
It could have been
fossilized.
A sperm from a worm, and the worm was in the whale.
They found. There's a picture of it somewhere. Check this out. You should show a little initiative here, Hal.
These are all animal things. I thought that sperm. I saw the picture of it, and I thought it was. Almost as cute as a panda.
Well, you know, I threw away your rundown here, your biography. And there are some things on there that I mistakenly got mixed up with my other things. And that was just... What has a lot of your research been on?
My research focuses on the craziness of human animals, how we think about animals and how we relate to them and how we bring them to their lives. And then our moral ambivalence, for example, how we can love some and how we can eat other ones.
Yeah, okay. Is it cultural? I mean, it varies culture to culture as to which are loved and which are eaten?
Oh, it varies widely from culture to culture. So that puppy that you have in your house that you're falling in love with right now, if you took that puppy to, you know, maybe Thailand or Korea, you might look at that puppy and say, "Man, that looks as good as a Big Mac. I think I'll have it for lunch."
You know, she would not. By the time you got done shaving it, I mean, there's nothing there.
Yeah, they tend to go for bigger dogs.
It's like 17 pounds of nothing.
Yeah, you know,
it's not good eating. In fact, I might put a tag on her just in case it ever. A little not good eating tag. Okay. So there are no innate, like the human fear of snakes, we keep going back to snakes, something like that. That's not some innate thing, anthropologically speaking, in the Homo sapien?
Well, that's sort of a tough one. Generally speaking, snakes are the most common fear, like in the United States. So, however, it's by far the most common fear. But it's completely undeserved for that fear. But in the United States, each year, less than 10 people are killed or bitten by poison, by poisonous snakes.
Yeah.
The creature that's most likely to injure you is the dog.
Yeah, that makes
sense. So that puppy you have is probably not your puppy, but 5 million people are bitten by dogs each year, and about two dozen people are killed by dogs each year, vastly more than killed by snakes.
And the old people who trip over their dogs, like even as we're speaking right now.
85,000 old people a year will trip over a dog and wind up being taken to the hospital with a broken something or other.
Yeah, I've just not broke my something or other, but I've definitely tripped over my dog.
Be careful about it.
Repeatedly. Okay, I don't know where to go with after that. So you're saying what?
Yeah, what I'm saying is that our bottom line is that the relationships we have are offer this incredible lens on how to look at so many aspects of human nature. They're part of every aspect of our lives, and they bring up all the sort of moral conflicts that we have to deal with. That really transcend human-animal interactions. It's a study in both the best and the worst in human nature, and to me, this is a new science called anthrozoology.
Yeah, that's right.
I think it's one of the hottest things going. It's absolutely an incredibly interesting field of study.
Is that where the theory of mind comes in?
Yeah, theory of mind. Yeah, that's a great question. Theory of mind comes in because. Theory of mind refers to the idea, we attribute to other people the idea that they can think and that they can think sort of like we can think. Well, we sort of, you know, the question is, does your dog know what you're thinking? Does your dog have a theory of mind? And
doesn't know what I'm saying.
Chimpanzee have a theory of mind. Yeah. So that gets into the issue of ethics. You know, if a creature has a theory of mind, if it's conscious, do we have a right to eat it? And so it gets to some really deep philosophical
issues. Why wouldn't
issues.
We? Why wouldn't we? Everyone's entitled to something, a tasty theory of mind. But I know that then you get to the point where you don't eat anything that is ever living.
I think you're right. I think you can wind up in a place that makes it very hard to get through your day.
Yeah. Because, you know, my vegan friends, and I had one, what was his name? Anyway, my vegan friends, I always tell them, you think a carrot doesn't scream when you pull it out of the earth without even announcing yourself?
Well, I'm gonna defend your vegan friend. Okay. And you know, to me, the vegans in this world are unlike a lot of us, including me, and probably you as well.
Probably.
We sort of construct a moral world where we can sort of avoid some of the really tough questions.
Yeah.
And your vegan friend thinks about these things in serious ways, and then actually makes, to me, a difficult life-changing decisions because of that. I mean, I sort of know the arguments against eating meat. I know them really well, and mm-hmm. they're really good. Mm-hmm. But yet I cannot resist the smell of bacon. Mm-hmm. And I've sort of made peace with that.
Yeah.
So, but a lot of people haven't. And I'm not I'm not a moral model.
You're not. Okay. But you know they have bacon seaweed. Now, did you see that? They developed the seaweed, which tastes like bacon. I don't know if it smells. It probably smells like seaweed, though, but it tastes like bacon.
I've got a friend who runs a excellent vegan restaurant in Asheville, Plant, and I had a maple bacon ice cream there that had neither bacon nor milk in it. It was vegan. It was absolutely stunningly good, and tastes like bacon, and it tastes like great bacon ice cream. Believe it or not.
Oh, it sounds terrible. That sounds just terrible, Hal.
I know it sounds terrible. I bought it. I got it because I thought this is going to be impossible to make taste good.
Yeah.
And it was fabulous.
You're a very forgiving guy. And you're a good guy. Well, there was something for the seaweed thing. Oh, yeah, the whole thing about, you know, eating animals. I mean, animals eat animals. I mean, where do we look for our moral compass?
Oh, we don't look.
Good?
We do not look for other animals. The list of cruelties in the animal world are vast.
So we got a lot to work with here, is what I'm saying. I mean, isn't that a good indicator? As because we are animals, are we not?
Ah, but this is where I think you're getting to a really fundamental question. By the way, you should run a philosophy show. That's really a great question. And to me, that's one of the things that we are animals, but I think we're different. Some of my animal rights friends disagree, but I think there's a big difference between humans and animals. I think it has to do with exactly that question.
Yeah.
We are responsible for our behavior in ways that other creatures are not. My cat is a serial killer, and I do not hold her responsible for this. And she's not only a killer; she's a torturer. You know,
she could
work in Guantanamo Bay. Yeah. She loves to torture things.
Yeah.
And I don't.
It's part of it.
I don't yell at her when she kills stuff.
No.
But I wouldn't let my kids do that, and I would hold other people responsible. So no, I think we have to hold ourselves to a higher moral standard than other creatures.
Than your cat.
Than my cat. That's pretty low
so that's,
bar.
That's pretty low bar, right? As I'm saying, we could not necessarily, you know, mass murder the things we eat or whatever and eat them.
Yeah, well, we don't want to turn to evolution for our moral guide, for moral guidance.
Why not?
Because if we do, then it would be okay to commit adultery, rape, mass murder, slavery, all sorts of kinky sexual deviations that you probably wouldn't approve of. All that stuff.
You don't know.
Just fine. You're right. I don't.
You don't know me like that. Huh?
What do you know?
Because of evolution, you mean you say because we were this in the past, so we can't look to that for what we should be now? Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying that's absolutely true.
Yeah.
Yeah, we don't want to. Yeah, when people tell me things are good because they're natural, I say, yeah, poison ivy's natural.
I'm with you there, totally. Yeah, I'm totally with you. Are you still there?
I'm still there. Still
you get so quiet sometimes. You must be thinking about stuff before you say that. What's that like?
I'm a real deep thinker, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, I was going to say something else now, and it was pertaining to what we were talking about before that. What was that now? Oh, I know. I saw this thing the other day about the hand of a chimpanzee is more evolved than the hand of a human. Did you see that the other day?
I saw it, but I didn't read it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, these internet things, I just sort of read the title and just, you know, go on to the...
No, this was a legitimate paper that somebody wrote for some legitimate
scientific
publication and said that actually chimpanzee hand, we had a common ancestor and all that, and we split. This is a while back. And then our hand is almost the same as the one of that ancient ancestor, common ancestor, but the chimpanzee hand is greatly different and greatly evolved and really quite lovely if you look at a chimpanzee's hand.
Well, I would totally believe that. The thing that's interesting about, you know, we talk about evolution of us and chimpanzees is that the number of genes that actually separate us are shockingly small.
Yeah.
You know, we share something like, you know, 98%, the estimates vary, but, you know, 98-99% of our genes with chimpanzees. But the big thing is that our brain is three times as big as a chimpanzee. And to me, that counts for something. So to me, this idea that, well, chimpanzees, you know, can use rudimentary tools and stuff like that and might have a hand that's more advanced than ours. There's one thing that they don't have, which separates us from them, is they don't have the ability to imitate the way that we do. They can imitate stuff, but humans are just natural apers. We are the copycats of the animal world, and that's what enables us to. So we can transmit information in ways that are vastly greater than any other species, and that's what's enabling me to talk with you right now and be on the radio.
You mean you never? Chimpanzees are great at it. Did you ever see that show where they were at a detective agency and it was all chimps, and they were dressed up and were out and some were wearing bow ties, some had regular ties and cravats, I guess you'd call them, and they were on the phone and they were talking, they were laughing at one another. And
I did not
remember
see that.
Jerry, you got to be older. Remember that? What was that called?
Lancelot Link.
I rest my case with Lancelot Link. They are great imitators. They can do everything we can do, and it's a lot cuter when they do it.
Well, they're definitely cuter when they're small, and then they get bigger. They will rip your face off, and I mean that literally.
Yes, I know that's happened. Did you? Have
yes,
you had,
it did happen.
Have you had monkey or primate pets?
No.
Okay. And let me ask you this other. That's what just. I know we're sort of running over time here, but the whole thing about pets. Why are some things suitable for pets and others not? Do they have to be willing to be subservient to the human will to be considered a good pet and really cute?
No, they don't. They don't have to be really cute, and you can even see that in the pet, you know, the most common pet, dogs. I mean, some dogs are really cute, and some dogs are really horrific looking, and we've even bred them to be that way.
Yeah,
and then the other thing is the cultures vary in pets. For example, in Japan right now, amongst the most popular pets are these giant beetles.
Yeah.
So cultures.
When you say giant, how big are we talking?
We're talking about. Not as big as your fist, but maybe half as big as your fist.
Okay.
Yeah. The beetles are not that cute.
No.
Except for Ringo.
And they're pets now?
Yeah.
Okay.
They have whole stores in Japan for beetle paraphernalia. Little cute little houses and stuff like that.
Okay. And your point is?
The point is that the animals that we choose to bring into our lives are very culturally dependent. So, for example, Saudi Arabia, dogs are very rarely kept as pets.
Okay. And what is mostly kept as a pet in Saudi Arabia?
Cats are more likely to be kept as pets.
Of course. Okay, well, it's been great talking with you, Al Herzog. And no, the book is fantastic. I love it. And I probably didn't give you a fair shake here, being myself, and I apologize for that.
You should. But,
yeah, okay. See, I'm bigger than my evolution.
I've really enjoyed being on your show. You're lots of fun.
You know, the book is called Some We Love, Some We Hate, Some We Eat, Al Herzog. Thanks so much, Al.
Thank you for having me on.
Okay, back to those Smoky Mountains there. It sounds beautiful out there.